Hi, I'm Claire Mitchell QC. Welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. I'm a lawyer who specialises in miscarriage of justice cases, and we're bringing you this podcast because we want to tell you about the women who were accused, prosecuted, convicted, and ultimately executed as witches in Scotland.
I'm Zoe Venditozzi, and I'm a writer who's always had an interest in the witches, and I feel that this dark mark against Scotland needs a reckoning.
The campaign Witches of Scotland wants three things. Firstly, a pardon for all those convicted of witchcraft. Secondly, an apology for all those who were accused as witches. And finally, a national monument in recognition of all those who are affected by this terrible miscarriage of justice.
Over the forthcoming weeks, we'll be talking to a whole host of experts about the history and the modern day connections to the Witches of Scotland. Hello, and welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. This is episode 46 of 6. Claire, see what you did there. That's very funny. Okay. Sorry, I'll do it again because obviously nobody can see the piece of paper I've got in front of me.
No, just leave that in.
Is that okay? Just leave it in.
People will find out that we actually do write some things down, Zoe. That might surprise some folk.
It might, that's true. Well, okay, so we're on episode 46 and today we've got a cracker where we've gone up north of where we are just now to talk to two fantastic historians and activists that have really achieved a lot up there in Orkney. So they are Ragnhild Jusland and also Helen Woodsford Dean. But before that, Claire, is there any news you'd like to talk about today?
Do you think now that people know that we actually sometimes write things down, they might know that we can write other stuff down, Zoe?
I should stop pretending that we're freestyling this, probably.
I mean, it's not far off freestyling.
Yes, it's seat of the pantsing, definitely.
For
sure.
Well, we've got some great news to start with. And that great news is that we've heard from Leo Igwe on his Facebook page, the page is Advocacy for Accused Witches, that Catherine, the young girl that we spoke about in episode 29 with Leo, who was accused of being a witch by her classmates in primary school and was thrown out of school, she has found a new school. Apparently, some generous benefactor in New Zealand has assisted with some kind of payment to assist her to get into a new school, and that's what's happened. So with Leo's assistance and focusing on getting her back into her education, we're delighted to see that Catherine has in fact got back and is once again at school. So it's really great.
Oh, that's great.
Her school has only been slightly disrupted by this accusation.
I hope that now that she's gone to a new school that she can have a fresh start and leave all that nonsense behind her.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, I mean, we come back to this again when people say to us, well, what's the point of looking into the case of the witch trials that were hundreds of years ago? People were different then. The fact is that people weren't so very different because it's still happening now. So that's why it's still of relevance and it's still important, because I think it could happen again. The whole idea is that it's people that are often sort of picked on and picked out for being vulnerable in some way. And that's obviously what happened to Catherine. So I'm really delighted to hear that there's a happy ending.
There is, Zoe, but sadly, as you would see if you go onto that Facebook page, recently there has been quite a spate of accusations, mm-hmm. not only from the continent of Africa, but I think there's also one that you saw in the press recently.
Yes, unfortunately, over the Halloween weekend in Chechnya, three women were arrested for witchcraft. Now, I'm going to have a bash at the names, and I'm very, very sorry when I get these names wrong, okay? But I think it's important that we name them. So the three suspects, or the three accused, are called Zulai Kurishevaya, Tumisha Kuno Mirovaya and Irina Adievaya. And they were, this is a quote, caught red-handed with maps, tarot cards, and even a magical stone as they attempted to conjure. So it was investigated by a Chechen news station called Grozny TV. And they said that the women had been getting filmed secretly for about 2 weeks. And the video footage of them showed them saying that they could do healing and they could do divination. They said they're natural healers rather than being witches. And it's just awful, actually. So they've been accused of violating Islamic and Russian law by telling people they can fix their lives in exchange for a fee. So really no different to cunning folk or charmers in the past here. So they have been accused now, and they have to be assessed for having mental illness or being possessed. Then they have to complete a form of therapy before getting released and signing a formal agreement to not do sorcery again. So it's really quite strange, actually. I mean, strange to us, obviously, but it's quite scary that these people have been accused. It does seem as if the articles that I'm looking at, that they've now been released without a formal charge, although it seems that the court ordered them to sign a promise to cease practicing magic. So I don't know. It's a kind of, it's a strange story, that one. And you wonder if there's more of a backstory to it, if it's that they'd annoyed somebody, or if they were in the way for something, or if it really is culturally seen there that there are people that are, as it was believed here in those days, back in the days of the witch trials, that they really are doing a form of magic that's like dark magic, or, you know, that's in league with the devil, I guess. So the devil's not mentioned there. And they seem like a mix of things, like a magical stone and tarot, and I don't know, it's a bit odd.
The thing is that although there seem to be witches in all different cultures, it means different things to different people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's again interesting that there are women that are being accused.
Yeah.
And what the women were trying to do is heal people's ills, it would appear, which doesn't seem like the worst thing. But I suppose the difficulty is we just don't have the full story about it. We can't actually tell.
Yeah. It's hard to know sort of where the truth is with things as well, and how much is kind of gossipy. But anyway, it's a horrible, horrible situation. And obviously, again, goes to why it's important that we keep talking about this, so that we understand that it's superstition, and it's a way of accusing people, and they can't really stand up against it, which is awful. But in happier news, Claire, I believe that there is some statue updates that occurred in the UK.
There is. We should definitely not start a new section called Statue Updates, because that will be like too much pressure on me. Plus, there isn't a new statue every week. So,
well, you know, you could make that happen, Claire. No, too much.
I could make it happen, but only if I started making up statues, which, you know, is something that I feel quite comfortable with doing.
I don't think it'd be very good for your standing as a legal professional if you just started making stuff up like that, though. This is an irregular part of the show.
I'm glad.
Then, not regular. Okay. So where is the statue that you will speak of?
The statue that I will speak of was pointed out to us by Linda J.H. on Instagram. And she sent us a really, really lovely note. She says, "Hi, firstly, I just wanted to say I love your podcast and the work you're doing on the campaign. I've just listened to episode 43 and the news item about statues of women. I believe that was the Italian woman."
Yeah, the sexy socialist.
Yeah. Returning to what Linda says, she says, "I want to share with you our statue in Oldham. On the 14th of December 2018, on the same day as the unveiling of the Emmeline Pankhurst statue in Manchester, we also unveiled the statue of our working class suffragette, Annie Kenny. This was such a proud moment for our town. She stands in front of an old town hall. I was part of the Annie Kenny project, which raised money for the statue and awareness of Annie and her role in the suffragette movement. This group was made up of women and men from our town and was headed by our MP, Jim McMahon." And she sent us, which we'll put on the socials, a brilliant photograph of Annie Kenny. She's a fully clothed lady, which is...
Thank goodness.
Yeah, different from the Italian one. She's wearing the clothes of her day, and she's standing with her hands outstretched, with a bell in one hand and with a piece of paper in the other. And she looks like she means business. She has got a serious expression in her face, and it's quite clear that she's going to get the vote. So I'm really, really pleased to see another statue of a woman that we can remember for progressing women's rights. I think that's brilliant.
Cool. So, Claire, do we have some accused witches to talk about today to remember?
Yes, we do. I've looked up today, using, as ever, the Survey of Scottish Witchcraft and the Interactive Witch Map, a number of women who were accused of witchcraft in Orkney. We've already covered one of the most famous trials of Orkney, so I thought I would go to slightly less well-known people. The first woman is Marjorie Papley. The start date of her accusation was the 3rd of November 1642, and the end date of the accusation was the 2nd of August 1648.
Six years.
Yeah. I don't know whether that means that the case was started then and ends then, It appears to be that, but that's a really long time for someone to have a witchcraft accusation outstanding. And the characterisation of the accusation was that she was implicated by another witch. The accusations about her came from the questioning of another suspect that we're going to speak about in a minute, Barbara Boundy. No details of any witchcraft came from Papley herself, and she and her son denied all the charges. And in fact, it appears what her son did was make complaints about the way that his mother was being dealt with by those who were interrogating her. And maybe that's why she didn't make any confession, because he appears to be quite a middle class sort of person. He certainly had the ability and the wherewithal to make the authorities listen to the fact that he was making a complaint about her treatment. And maybe that's why she didn't confess. What was interesting was that Barbara Boundy claimed that she had been encouraged to name other women in return for her life. So it appears that somebody was putting pressure on Barbara Boundy to say, if you tell us who the other witches are, you might survive with your life. Now, we unfortunately don't know the outcome of that allegation against Marjorie Papley. We very much hope, obviously, as we do in all these cases, that she wasn't found a witch and sentenced to death. But hopefully, because she didn't confess, there's at least some scope or some prospect for the idea that that didn't happen to her. The next person I want to speak about is the woman who accused her, Barbara Boundy. We know that she was from Orkney, or her place of residence was in Orkney. But originally, we think from the records that she'd been originally from Shetland, as there appears to be records that she was, quote, a wanderer and a vagabond. So you kind of get this idea that this poor woman who has got no home, she's a wanderer and she's a vagabond, is being picked upon, being accused of being a witch, and being told that if she names other people in the community as witches, she might escape with her life. Mm. Now, she said, or admitted to, going to witches' meetings, dancing, and then she, having said that she'd been to these meetings, then denied it and says, I'm retracting all of this. I was forced to do this and I was urged to name others. And it's really, really great that the records record this degree of detail that allows us to look back on this. What she said, first of all, before she retracted her statement, was that she'd been speechless for one day, and as a result, people had said that she'd been taken by the fairies. So she'd literally been unable to say anything for a day, and people said that she'd been taken by the fairies. She denied that she'd been taken by the fairies, and she also denied that she was able to identify other witches. So she made it clear, even though she made a false confession, that she had been forced into it and forced to identify other people. So I'm very much hopeful that neither of those women, one of them having confessed and then denied it and the other having never confessed to it, I'm very hopeful that their outcome was that they did not die. Zoe, there was another woman from Orkney.
Yeah, and this lady has very little detail, as is often the case, but still is absolutely important that we name her. So her name was Agnes Scotty. She was from Orkney. Her socioeconomic status is listed as being very poor. And in fact, her occupation is described as being a vagabond. She's described as a wanderer who was guilty of cursing. And that's all we know about her. So Agnes Scotty, that's all we've got.
I'd like to remind everybody that if you're ever going up to Orkney, we were contacted and had a chat with Yvonne Nicol, the archive assistant at the Orkney Library and Archive. And she said if you give her a day's notice if you're coming up to Orkney, they can look out some of the trial papers, and they have really, really good records of witchcraft trials. So if you're interested in that, please do get in contact. They've got an amazing archive place. I went up and had a look at it, and it's really great that we can go back and look at those documents. So if you're thinking about going to Orkney and want to know about that, get in contact with the archive section of One Nickel.
So joining us today for the podcast are two fantastic historians and activists that are going to tell us about what they have achieved in Orkney. Now, the two women we're going to be speaking to are called Helen Woodsford-Dean, who lectured in archaeology before moving to Orkney in 2009, where she now works as a tour guide and celebrant. Her interests are religion and ritual, both academically and personally, being the deputy presiding officer of the Scottish Pagan Federation. She's also co-convener of the Orkney Greens and believes passionately in justice at all levels. Joining her is her good friend and co-activist, Dr. Ragnhild Ljusland, who has been a lecturer with the University of the Highlands and Islands since 2009, initially with the Centre for Nordic Studies and later with UHI Archaeology Institute. Her academic background is in Scandinavian language and literature, graduating from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology in 2008 with a PhD in sociolinguistics. So since joining UHI, Ragnhild has looked at various linguistic and sociolinguistic topics, as well as literature and runology. So we are delighted to be joined today by Ragnhild and Helen. Hello, hello. So you guys met Claire. Am I right in thinking this, that Claire was up working in Orkney and she was put in touch with you and went and met you? Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, we had a lovely cup of coffee and cake.
We did. It was such a gorgeous day as well. I was up working in Orkney and I wanted to know who the people were who had made the Orkney Memorial. And we had such a lovely afternoon. We went up to the memorial and we had a real good discussion about it, which hopefully we'll get lots of the info from you about, and about the events that occurred around it. And then we walked down and we went past the church where people were probably held as witches, and we sort of looked at that as we went past. And then, not best of all, but equally good, we went for a really nice coffee and cake afterwards. It was great fun.
Why was it in particular, Raggy and Helen, that people put Claire in touch with you specifically? What is your part in this event?
We were kind of like the co-leaders. It was originally our idea. And kind of like, if it wasn't for the fact that we needed an umbrella organisation to handle funds when we were putting in for funding bids from the council, we would probably have done it ourselves.
Oh, that's a bit like us then. So like a dynamic duo. Sort of,
yeah, thing. But we must emphasise that we've had lots of help, though. The Heritage Society, the Orkney Heritage Society, put down a subcommittee that we were invited into, and also the Orkney Library and Archive were very, very helpful.
Now, we had lots and lots of help, but it was kind of like we were the initial impetus for it, and we were kind of like the drivers for it as well.
You definitely need somebody that's really focused and is going to keep going with it, I think, don't you? It has to be a passion project to a certain extent. How do you two know each other?
We met for this project.
Yeah, in 2012. And now it feels like we've been friends forever, but it was this project that started it all.
And what are your backgrounds that led you to this? Or was it just something that just you became aware of and got involved with?
There was a lecture put on. I was put on by, was it the University of the Highlands and Islands or was it the Nordic Studies Centre, Raggy?
It was the Centre for Nordic Studies, which is part of the University of the Highlands and Islands, had invited Professor Liv Williamson from the University of the Arctic to share her work with the memorial at Stainless in Finnmark. And after that, Helen came to me in the office and said, why don't we try and have a memorial in Orkney too? And I said, yes.
Now, when you say the office, what office is this?
Oh, back in 2012, that was something called the Centre for Nordic Studies.
Ah. So are you an academic, Raggy?
Yeah, I'm with the University of the Highlands and Islands. I'm now in the Archaeology Institute. I've moved since then, but I'm interested in witches because it's part of the area of culture and heritage.
So when Helen came to you and said, I want to do something to memorialise these people. First of all, why did you think it was a good idea? Why did you think it was an important thing to do?
Because these people were innocent and it's a crime that doesn't exist anymore. Although, of course, it was a crime back then, and there was a law against witchcraft. But in my worldview, witchcraft isn't real, so they can't have been guilty of the things they were accused of. So it was a huge miscarriage of justice.
Very much exactly the same as our thinking is. Helen, did you come from a background with history, or when you went to the talk, was this news to you?
I've got an archaeology background. I'm an archaeologist. I'm really interested in prehistory, but I've got a personal, my interests as an archaeologist have always been about religion and ritual, but I'm also a practicing faith leader. It sounds a bit weird saying that. I wasn't at the time, I was just the local organiser for Orkney. But since in the last couple of years, I'm now the deputy presiding officer for the Scottish Pagan Federation.
Ah, how interesting. Now, that's really interesting to get you on, because the idea about the way that the campaign has been embraced by modern day pagans is super interesting to us. There are some people within the community that will claim the witches, with inverted commas, as their own, as their people. And I'd wonder what pagan people today that would identify as pagans, what they think about that. So it's really interesting to have your take on that, actually, Helen.
One of the things you learn when you attempt to lead pagans is they will never agree on anything. I'm very respectful of anybody who identifies, self-identifies with those women as witches. But I'm kind of like, although I'm a person of faith, I've been trained as a scientist, because that's how archaeologists are trained. And I know the history of modern witchcraft. And personally, I think that modern witchcraft, which we might want to call neo-witchcraft, is totally different to the fear of witches 300 or 400 years ago. Okay. And I actually think that modern witchcraft, it's not my personal opinion, but it's the opinion that I agree with. I think it was largely invented. So like the interwar years of the 20th century, it's largely an invented religion, came out of a particular zeitgeist that came out of a lot of different connections like folk magic and like ceremonial magic. But modern witchcraft and the accusations might be the same, because a lot of modern witches do have to fend off accusations of child abuse or worshipping Satan, things like that. But actually what modern witches do is nothing to do with what they were accused of when they have to deal with prejudice, or what they have to do, or what they accused of in the past. And one of the things I always said, I was the wrong person to lead the project because of my connection with paganism. But one of my remits has always been to try and educate people and say, there isn't the same connection. These people were not witches. They were Christians. They often were surprised when they were accused of witchcraft. What they might have been doing was practicing folk magic. But what comes up in the trial reports all the time is this constant, but everyone did it. And it was no more malicious than us choosing not to walk under a ladder. There was an accusation of a young male who was accused of witchcraft, and all he'd done was he'd walked backwards in a newly ploughed field. He'd walked backwards in a harrow to try and find out who his future wife would be. So he was obviously just practicing gentle divination. That was one of the things I had a lot of problem with, because I kind of have to balance this. We had a lot of people coming up on our creative days who had identified with that. And I was kind of having to be the objective scientist with it and say, no, it's not the case. As a consequence of that, one of the things I was really keen on, and Raggy kindly let me run with this a little bit, was I wanted to talk about how we scapegoat parts of society and how we still do it today. And although I know that prejudice against pagans is still alive and strong, a couple of years ago when we were getting the memorial put in, society was honing in on scapegoating people with disabilities, so-called benefit scroungers, or they were honing on attacking immigrants as kind of like an umbrella term. And I was kind of like trying to say, our focus is really, this project is just a historical project, unless we think about how we're still doing this today as a society. And let's be more conscious of that. And let's pledge that we're not going to do this again. Only we're not going to do it to any maligned sector of society.
Yeah, I think that's something that definitely we've discussed when we've had the occasional bit of negativity, you know, along the lines of, well, why bother? It was the past. It was hundreds of years ago. It's not my fault. Why are you wanting me to be involved in this? What's the point of an apology? And there's not been many people like that. For the most part, it's been very supportive. But that's definitely the line that Claire and I would take, which is that, you know, we're not there yet. We're not at some sort of magical, but excuse the pun really, where we are kind and compassionate and we don't scapegoat. There's still a problem with scapegoating vulnerable members of society. And to me, this is a very extreme example of that, where there was a very clear physical state involved problem solve. Again, I'm doing that in speech marks. Now it's maybe not as obvious, but it's still a problem. And I think that if we recognize what happened in the witch trials, then we're having a conversation that hopefully can lead us to a better place. It's not going to fix everything, but I think the more that we talk about it, the more we think about how we work together as a society and we work on social justice. I think that's really, really important. I think it's incredibly immature of people when they say, I just had a bit of back and forth with somebody about this on Facebook today, so it's a bit hot for me. But when people say, it had nothing to do with me, like, what do you want from me? You can't change history. And this charge of you can't change history is really fascinating to me, because to me, it's the complete opposite. It's really talking about history and making sure we've got it right and it's accurate and we understand it. That to me seems fairly obvious.
On a more intuitive level, though, and just going to venture into woo-woo territory, there is a way that you can change history. Quite a few people found Galahar, which is where we sited our memorial. They had previously found it to be quite a disturbing site. And when people went back to it, they said that the atmosphere there has changed. That could be wishful thinking. That could be projection. I don't know. But if you have, in a way, done, and I use the word in a more generic sense, but if you had carried out some sort of cleansing or exorcism on some level, that might be a way of saying that you're changing history, but you might be bringing peace to a place. And that can be important. That's why people go to visit places like, I don't know, they go to visit the concentration camps and things like that, and as maybe to bring a bit of peace to it.
It's because landscape is also mindscape. It's we can't look at a place without that place having a story. And I think what we've done with this project is change the story of Galahad, the old execution site in Kirkwall, and we've added a deeper layer of understanding and reconciliation with it.
Absolutely. Now tell us, you decided together, the two of you, Raggy and Helen, you were going to get a memorial. Now tell us, in short, how you managed to get that to happen. And then after that, I want to hear all about the choices that were made and what the actual memorial was.
Yeah, it was a long process, starting in 2012, and the memorial was finally in place in 2019. It wasn't just a piece of stone, though. The memorial itself is a piece of stone. It's a flat stone inscribed with a sundial, a picture of a sundial, and a text. But the project was so much more than that. And the longest part of the project was to win people over. And Helen did an awesome job with that. Helen sat on the interfaith group that brings together people from the various denominations and faiths in Orkney, and trying to let people know that this was not about blame or guilt or accusing the church of wrongs. It was not about that at all. So the first 5 years or 4 or 5 years were about that, about speaking to a lot of people and explaining, and the neighbors around Galahad. Did you want to add something there, Helen?
Yeah, it was all that sort of thing. It really caught its own momentum up in the last couple of years. It's a little bit difficult to explain until you know what it's like in Orkney. And one of our academic speakers in the afternoon of the inauguration day, Tim Morrison, he hit it on the head when he was talking about modern day witch hunts. And one of the ways that island communities protect themselves is when something unpleasant happens is they don't talk about it. And this was something that people really didn't want to talk about. It was something that was bad that happened in the past, but we don't do it anymore. And we were kind of like, we were just chipping very, very gently away at it. We knew it was going to be a really sensitive subject, that there might even be some people who, that Galahar is not developed, but there are houses all around it. And we were aware there might be people who just thought they were looking out on a nice bit of green space, not realizing what it was. But we were also trying to push the fact that actually it might be another attraction for tourists. There's a lot of interest in this. And we were kind of like just gently, gently pushing it, but not rushing it, and just getting as many people on side as possible. We letter dropped all the way around, and we had one letter of people saying that they really didn't like it. And we went to speak to them in person, and just one of our team went to speak to them in person and just talked them around and reassured them. And I think that was, it was just this gentle process of just going at it, but not rushing it.
Including the Orkney Heritage Society. They were not immediately keen to be the organization to take this project on, because that was not because they were against the memorial, but it was because they had recently worked on a different memorial to a ship that was sunk in World War One, and they'd had such hassle with that memorial, with safety concerns and cost and building and blah. So they were not keen to take on another memorial. So that led to a dialogue about the scale and form that the memorial would take. And one of the early ideas we had was about a sundial, and Helen had spotted a beautiful sundial on one of the 17th century gravestones at the St. Magnus Cathedral. So the first idea was to have a standing stone with a sundial on it, but that was too big for the Heritage Society, and they were worried about the upkeep and about the safety of it. So then it was scaled down to have a flat stone inscribed with a picture of a sundial, which doesn't require any maintenance. So it was that sort of dialogue as well. So with those adjustments, the Heritage Society were able to take on the project and have been very, very supportive since then. But then it was the creative aspect of the project. That was the part that I really, really enjoyed. We had a day in 2018 in the public library, which also houses the archive. And that's when the archive staff helped us make a display of the records that the archive holds of the witch trials. And then we had lots of different artists working in lots of different mediums coming in. And we had academics coming in. And together, we held this day that was open to anybody, families and everybody came in and learned a bit about the trials first, and then the artist helped them create something. So it was lots of things. It was a song. We made a song with the help of a musician, Corwin Broch. We made a book of prints with visual artist Jeannie Rose. There was a sound recording and a story workshop. There was a letter writing letters to the witches back in time to say what we think of them now. There was a poetry workshop. Am I forgetting something? There was so much going on that day.
Did you not do a poem, Helen?
I wrote a number of poems. I wrote 13 poems for them. And I wrote a poem with Reverend David Manish's help for the inauguration day as well. At the time, I was doing a creative writing course with the Open University. And I
that
the
book of poems was published online.
Is that available for people to get now?
Yeah.
Okay, great. We'll post a link to that as well. Now,
can I just share a piece of news though? Because the creative aspect of this will continue, because I've recently been given funding for a drama and creative writing project. Yeah. So now in January to March, there'll be creative writing workshops in Orkney and online where people can write a historical character narrative as a first person, trying to put themselves in the shoes of one of the accused, or also one of the people who weren't accused but were involved in the trial as a witness or accuser or the townsfolk or whatever. And once people have written their character, they get the chance to play that character in an improvised drama event where you get to live in the 17th century for a day and experience a witchcraft trial.
That's absolutely brilliant, because there's no better way than letting people to connect than by using their imagination, but then actually putting them in the shoes of the person who would have felt like that's a really, really, a really powerful thing. So well done. That sounds like an absolutely fantastic project. And do keep us updated with it so we can let people know, because I'm sure people would be so interested. We can share it on the socials.
I'm really excited about that. And I know that Maggie's the right person to lead it, because she designed the kind of like the live action role play that we did when we went out to open the St. Magnus Way. We went out to the island of Eggleszy and we murdered St. Magnus again. And I had a part in that. And I have to admit, it really did make me realize just what it's like when you do something like that. It brought it home. So I'm really quite excited about this art project.
Brilliant. I think, Raggy, you're going to be inundated with people. That's my only concern for you, that you'll have so many.
Yeah, I hope so.
Can you tell us a little about the people that were killed as witches in Orkney?
There was an unusually high number of them in Orkney. It's along with the east coast of Scotland. There was a high proportion compared to just the general numbers of the population. There was also a high number. I think we've got over 70 that we know of now.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons this was so bad here was that there was a vacuum of governance here, because in the early 1600s, the Earl of Orkney was arrested and put in prison in Scotland. And in 1614 to 15, his son tried coming back and retaking Orkney, and there was a rebellion and lots of political chaos. And on top of that, the Earl in question was first cousin with King James, who wrote demonology and started off the North Berwick trials. So I think that's how we ended up being so badly affected. There were also some chain trials. So in the 1620s, following all this political chaos, there was a big chain trial that led to a lot of accusations.
And in all the accusation cases, when people were accused, do you know the amount of people that were accused and killed? Were all of them killed, or were some of them acquitted? Do you know?
The sentence is not recorded for most of us. We can't know how many were killed, but for some of them, we do know. I think the case that really makes me hurt is the first one of Alison Balfour, because she was involved in this chaos around the Earl Patrick, and the Earl's brother John had a plan to poison Patrick, and involved in this poisoning plan was Alison Balfour. And then in the trial, the Earl's brother John is acquitted and Alison is convicted and executed. And the way that they get a confession from her is that they torture her horribly, and then they torture her family in turn, and then they come to her 7-year-old daughter, and when they torture that little girl, that's what breaks Alison. I can't talk about this without crying.
It's such a horrific story. So Alison was the servant of the person who was poisoning, and it wasn't her poisoning at all. She wasn't actually, as I understand it, part of it. Is that right? It was only said that she was part of it.
She's in a position where she can't defend herself, because the Earl and the Earl's brother would have been so powerful compared to her.
And she confessed. I mean, I'm sure our listeners will agree that it would move anyone to tears, Raggy. The idea that the way they got you to confess was to torture your family in front of you, including your children, was absolutely horrific. And Alison's name will be remembered by us for a long time onwards. Let's continue to remember her name and what happened to her, and let's hope that we can affect things in the future by trying to ensure things like this don't happen again by properly remembering people.
Alison was quite a high status woman, though. Even though she was a servant, she was quite high status. The majority of those accused were really low status. And I think Liv had done some work on, she said that the accusations really kick off the year after there's a harvest failure. So you've got people who are starving.
They're looking for somebody to blame for that, somebody to carry the can, somebody to take out all their kind of pain or worry or fear or, yeah. God, it's just so horrible, isn't it? And the fact that it still echoes with us and is so moving this many hundred years forward proves why getting a memorial is so important and proves why it's so important to educate the country and educate visitors to the country as well. I'm on a group about ancestry and heritage just now that's bizarre. And people, I think, that have a concept of Scotland, still, it's very much focused on tartan and castles and, I'm Scotch because my surname is McSomething. I'm making a face to the camera. It's really annoying because I think that can be maybe a good starting point. But then I think you really need to be open to what the actual history of Scotland is. And the fact is that Scotland and Scottish people in the past did some really, really terrible things. And we can understand them. You know, we can see what you've just said there, Helen, about a crop failure. We can have an understanding about, you know, poverty and a very real fear that you're going to starve. You know, we can understand all that. But we need to understand the things that went wrong. And I think the best way of doing that now is through things like the podcast or through things like you're talking about, Raggy, about doing the creative writing responses, but also through obviously things like memorials, because the memorials that are there, it means that it's not just people that are deliberately already interested. It's people that can just randomly come across memorial and read it and say, what, that happened here? I had no clue about that. And then hopefully they'll then be able to connect to other things and learn and understand the history of a country so it's much more complex and truthful. How did you go about deciding how it would look? I know you've talked about scaling it so that it didn't have, you know, the maintenance issues, and you've talked about cost and safety and that sort of thing. But how did you come up with the concept and get agreement on how it was going to look, and who designed it and who made it?
We had some really grand ideas to begin with, but we probably weren't going to be able to afford to do them, and there were health and safety issues. We realised that actually what we had to do was, particularly to get it past everybody and approve it, we were going to have to take it really, really minimalist. And we decided that there was a sense with that there was a power in just a quiet, minimal, I'm not going anywhere statement that often people have to really search out for, because it's faded considerably. So you really have to know where it is. And we've had a case before of people saying, I'm meeting you there, and I can't find it, and come and meet me, and I can't see where it is at all. And you get up there and they're on their mobile phone trying to look for it, and they're standing on it.
So it has a quiet dignity, though. It has a quiet dignity when you know it's there.
It does. It's my absolutely favourite memorial of all. And what I love about it, the expression, we've repeated it over and over again, they were just folk. How did you come up with that?
We were looking at the other memorials that have already been put in place in Scotland. And I think there's one that is just folk. I think it's Forfar.
Forfar, yeah.
And it's just folk. And I love the power of that one because it's got the play on the word just. It means only or simply, or that's all they were. They were just folk like you and me. Mm-hmm. And it also has that play on justice. But what we wanted to do was we wanted to render something in Orcadian dialect. That was very important to us, that it was done in Orcadian dialect. And instead of just, we used the word cheust, C-H-E-U-S-T, which loses that double play on simply and only. It loses one of the double meanings. I think it loses the meaning of justice, but it says they're only people.
It only loses it when you read it. When you hear people say it, it's still there.
Yeah, that's true.
We took the sundial design from one of the tombs in the cathedral. We wanted a direct link with the cathedral. And the newly retired stonemason, he chose the stone and he did the carving for us.
Oh, so lovely.
It got the links with the cathedral.
So a real community effort then. So it wasn't a case of getting an artist from somewhere else to come in and bid for it or anything like that. It was something that you'd come together as a committee and you got somebody locally to make it. I think that's really beautiful, actually, and really, really fitting.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And when you say it's just a slab, there's something else to the memorial? Yeah. Isn't there something secret to the memorial? Tell us about that.
It's a secret time capsule underneath. Yep, so it's a time capsule of metal, and inside there's a memory stick and copies of the things that were made during the creative days, all the prints and drawings and poems and letters and things that were written, and also photos from the creative day and the piece of music and all that went on the memory stick. And all this is wrapped around a bottle made by a local potter, Andrew Appleby. This is supposed to be, one of those witch bottles that you find where people traditionally put in urine and nail clippings and bent nails and things like that to try and make a spell. But our spell is about healing. So during the creative day, we encourage people to collect their own tears when things happened, like, for example, talking about Alison Balfour, and collect them using Q-tips and then put them in the bottle so that it's a healing spell.
I just thought that was so beautiful because I had no idea that when I was standing there under that, there was all that creativity that had been bundled up inside it for future generations to find out about. But if generations want to find out about all the work that you did now, can you tell them about the great book which is available to buy?
Yes, the new Orkney Antiquarian Journal, Volume 9, commemorating the victims of the Orkney Witchcraft Trials, which is for sale online if you go to Orkney Heritage Society, all in one word, .org.uk, and click on bookshop. You'll find it there.
Yeah, I got it, didn't I? When I was up there, you guys literally sent me down to the bookshop and I wandered down and got my copy of it, which was great. There's always copies in the local bookshop in Orkney if people are thinking about getting it. What's the name of the bookshop in Orkney that they've got copies in?
The Arcadian.
They stock it in the Orkney Museum shop as well. They've got an exhibit of a few things they found to do with witches in the Merchant Laird's Gallery as well.
Oh, fantastic. And can I say, on your suggestion, I went down to the library and I met the lovely librarian that was there, and she confirmed with me that if people wanted to see some records of the witchcraft trials, they only needed to give a day's notice. So if you happen to be up in Orkney and you want to find out about it, you can contact the Orkney Library.
Well, the other thing there is in the library and the archive is that the Orkney Heritage Society have their own storage area in the archive, and everything that we couldn't put into time capsule has been stored in there as well. So you can see all the things that were made on our creative day and all the veils that we made to take off. Because we didn't just unveil the flagstone, we had 13 different levels of material. So the first one, you'd start taking them off. We got some lovely flame print organza. And as you took them off, somebody read a couple of lines of the poem. And you kind of like went through this idea of going through ash and then flames. And then back at the bottom, there was a white sheet. And there's all the sheets of material are in the archive as well. So you can see all of those.
It's such a thought out idea. It's so sensitive and clever and so textured, and I just think it's really wonderful. It's not just a kind of a here's where this thing happened, you know. It's really thought out. I love it. Really clever.
In fairness, that wasn't my idea. It wasn't Aggie's idea. That was Corin Brock's idea, and him and his wife Kate Fletcher were our musicians, and they input a huge amount to the whole project, really.
But it's such a nice example of a community of people getting together. And, you know, I'm sure there was lots of discussion and dialogue and things changed and, you know, over time. And I know it wouldn't have been just really straightforward, but that's really wonderful what you've ended up with and such a significant symbol to remember.
Well, I need to mention the St. Magnus Players Drama Group on the day that, the inauguration day, they performed a short play by George Mackay Brown called Witch as well. And that was also such a great community effort.
What do you think to the idea that we're pushing for in our campaign about a state memorial?
A national memorial?
that the state pays for and, you know, and organises?
I think that's a great idea because it will be like it brings together all the local memorials. But I also think it's great that this is something that's come from the bottom up. That is the communities themselves who have taken the initiative, and the state memorial will just be a culmination of lots of local groups' efforts.
If it weren't for local groups over centuries, if it weren't for local people over centuries telling the story of these people and reminding us that it happened, we wouldn't even know about it.
Exactly.
So it's all due to local communities that have kept these stories of these people alive and while we still talk about them. I absolutely, absolutely agree, Raggy.
I'd like to have a national memorial where it was then possibly a starting point for people visiting the country, who, and then there was then it had been mapped where all the other communities had different memorials and their different approaches right across Scotland, so that you could feasibly tour around and see what the stories were and remember in each significant location.
One of the things that's important to realise now that makes it relevant is that it felt like fact. So for the folk in the 1600s, the devil was real and magical thinking was real. So that when somebody mutters a curse to you and then a few days later your horse stumbles and breaks its leg, that feels like a real cause and effect. Mm-hmm. I think today we should recognize that we can't blame the people in the 17th century for thinking like that, because that was part of their culture. And also today, we can think like that for when you hear things, for example, conspiracy theories online or in social media. We're making the same types of connections as they did. It's just that our minds are focused on a different issue, but the process of thinking is very similar. It's like joining dots that shouldn't be joined.
Yeah, absolutely. Humans want to create stories. We're storytellers and we create narratives about everything. So we want to be able to have a connection. We want to be able to understand the world. And we've had conversations with people online saying people back then were just stupid. There's like, no, we haven't. There's no difference in the intelligence of people then and the intelligence of people now. It was just they had a separate belief structure. It was a different belief structure, but it doesn't mean people were operating at different levels of, for example, emotional intelligence. People didn't feel differently then about things. They were just operating with a different construct of the world around them. And I mean, we have never gone in for the idea that the church should apologise. The church, for example, didn't actually prosecute these people, although the church was involved in investigation and the church was involved in getting statements and the church was involved in inverted commas torture, you know, keeping people awake and stuff. It was the state that prosecuted. So almost all cases the state prosecuted, except for those extrajudicial sort of killings that we know about. So I think that we can recognise that what happened to these people were wrong and the thinking behind why it happened was wrong, namely that when difficulties occur in life, you look for someone else to blame. You say, why is my lot like this? Why isn't my lot better than this? And it's perhaps, if we can learn anything from people then, we can look at them and say, let's try not to do that in our lives, even though when you look around the world, it seems overwhelmingly that we're still repeating it, but at least we can try to do better. And I think that's all we can ask for.
Let's not forget that at the time, it was the king who was leading this. The paranoia starts right at the very top. This is the person who's in charge of the church and in charge of, you know, owns everything, all powerful, put in place by God. And it's their paranoia that's kicking off much of this. And, you know, this is not just poor, stupid peasants. This is at the very, very top. but we've got examples in Orkney of some of our really quite senior bishops in Orkney at the time were actually fighting this. Bishop
George Graham
was at Scale. He was actually saying no, and he was actually trying to fight it. But you know, when you bear in mind that it's at every level of society, and I kind of like think we're in a very privileged position. You know, in the latter half of the 20th century, in the 21st century, we don't actually live with death on an everyday basis. And most of us are going to expect to live into our 70s and perhaps our 80s. But, you know, death was so much ever present before and for these people. And in many ways, I think they were looking at life as just a dress rehearsal. And kind of like, it's just the prep you do before you get the afterlife. And that afterlife was really, it was a promise of a wonderful afterlife, but it was quite an awful one as well. And I think they were genuinely scared for the care of their souls.
Absolutely, Helen. That's one of the things that really annoys me about the extra indignity that you don't think about when people were accused of witchcraft and executed. The additional horror that would be laid at their door was that they never would get to see God. They never would get to see their family. They weren't going to be buried in consecrated ground. So it wasn't even just the horror of the bodily thing that would happen to them when they were killed. It was a horror that was going to last for eternity.
Mm.
That's not cheery for an afternoon chat, is it?
No. But it is a fact, though, you know, and one of the things that that's been said to us recently was, let them rest in peace. And I just sort of think like, well, if you do believe in a Christian structure like that, they're not resting in peace. They're not. And I just think it's something that we're obliged, I think, to try and write that as much as we can. You know, you can't obviously bring people back, but you can alter the way that people think about what happened in those days and at least let them know what happened in those days, you know, because one thing we've talked about before is as well, is that would have hugely affected the person that was accused, their family and their friends, and then the family's children and their children and so on, because that would be so shameful and so stigmatizing. If your mum was executed as a witch, you know, the child and the grandchild and probably the great grandchild, they'd all have a memory of that. They would all know, and they'd be viewed negatively, I would imagine, by their community.
I've actually met somebody who is a descendant of one of the Orkney accused. Yeah.
And is that a story that was passed down their line then?
Yeah, yeah. It's a descendant of Maribel Cooper from Bursay. And yeah, but now in the 21st century, they weren't ashamed of that anymore. That was more of a curiosity now. But you're absolutely right that a few generations ago, it would probably have been shameful. Yeah.
I would argue, though, that I'm a teacher, and I would argue that you can see generational trauma and the impact that has on people. And, you know, it could be argued that the stigma of that now is seen as a curiosity, but it could be that several, you know, like maybe 6-7 generations back, you know, people might have lost income and they might have fallen in harder times. You know, they might have become more brutal. There might have been, you know, more, I don't know, like more drinking or more violence or whatever. And then that could be passed down and passed down and passed down until the cycle gets broken. Now, I know that for some people, they might be like, come on, it was a long time ago. Could it still be echoing? But I think it does echo. I absolutely think it does, not in a way necessarily that people would think about it, you know, in an open way, but every generation of parenting wreaks some sort of havoc potentially on each child that's born in each generation. So
yeah, so there are many more victims than those who stood trial. Yeah. And some of those victims, as Peter Marshall pointed out to me, some of those victims are actually the witnesses, those who testify against the witch, who I get angry with sometimes, I must admit, for saying these things. But they are also victims because they live in a world where they believe that they have been the victims of a curse against them, that somebody has put malevolent magic on them. So they are victims because they believe that, and they're really frightened.
Mm-hmm. but also terrified that the finger of blame might get pointed at them. And if they say, oh, it was actually my neighbour, they're less likely to get accused. You know, as you see that working with children sometimes, you can see that the way the brain, the cogs turn, and they sort of like, it wasn't me, it was him, you know, and you can see that's probably how that played out.
Oh, you see it among adults too. Oh, you see it with, yeah. If somebody's bullied at work, for example, and all the other colleagues don't speak up and start whispering behind her back, and suddenly you have a person who's isolated and scapegoated, it's the same sort of process.
For sure, yeah. I think that's an unfortunate aspect of human psychology, but, you know...
But one that we can recognise and try and guard against. Like, I don't think we can change ourselves, but we can at least try and do better.
That's very positive.
That's a very positive thing. And I'm trying to bring it back from the brink of of eternal horror that I mentioned.
That's very good of you, Claire. Well done.
You never know what seeds you're sowing with any project like this, but if you just change one heart, you know, you're using empathy to sort of like create some compassion just in one person. You've got no idea how that's going to ripple out at all.
That is an absolutely beautiful thought to end on. On that very note, we should say to Helen and Raggy, thank you so very much for being with us today. We really appreciated hearing about it. And we thank you so much for the fantastic work you've done on the Orkney Memorial.
Yeah,
thank you
so much.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure to be asked to speak about it. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us for today's podcast. As ever, please have a look at our socials, as the young folks say. So we're very active, obviously, on Twitter, which is where you can have a chat with us. We've got a YouTube station, we've got Instagram, we've got a website, we've got a TikTok, but I think there's only one TikTok on there. And obviously, you can get the podcast in lots of different places. So please do tell people, because obviously, the more people that are engaging with us, the likelier a chance we have of success with the campaign. And one way in which you can tell people about the podcast is by reviewing. And I found this review today because I was just having a look on the Apple podcast, and it was quite gratifying because I looked up witches. So I started to put in the search box witches, and the first thing that comes up now is Witches of Scotland is the first podcast. That's quite nice. There was a review by somebody called, well, who's calling themselves Joe Mossy. So if that's you, hello, and thank you for leaving this review. And they have said, stumbled upon this podcast by accident, tick so many of my boxes of interest, Scotland, history, law, injustice, witches, the down-to-earth delivery, banter, and openness of Zoe and Claire. Openness could be that we just have verbal diarrhea, but we'll move on. With sharing and revisiting previous episodes with clarifications or emphasis is fantastic and a great way to show that history comes from books and or verbal transfer. This is open to interpretation, and naturally, we have a tendency to forget about the social and political norm of the time. For me, I'm happy to be called a witch. Now, not only is that a lovely review, but also it makes me remember to tell you that in an upcoming episode, Claire and I are going to be talking about the way in which history is recorded and the way in which people sort of accept history is still under debate in some areas. So there's one thing in particular, which is about how the witches of Scotland and Britain, and I think sort of generally, are shown in stereotypical form, and how Claire and I initially understood how that had come about historically. But there's been a bit of debate recently since we recorded that initial podcast, which was right back at the beginning. So we're going to be revisiting that in a podcast to come about the sort of the images and the way in which witches are described visually.
The great ill-wife debate, it sparked a real interest in... How did it come about? Why do we think of witches with pointy hats as old women with cauldrons with cats? What was it that some academics are saying that it's because of alewives? Some academics are saying, nope, it's just a random chance of different things coming together. So we'll be discussing that.
We'll talk about that a bit more. And just before we go, I would just like to say, just please remember that David, our lovely sound engineer that's really had his work cut out with this introduction and ending of this podcast night, let me tell you, Claire and I have we really owe him big time generally, but particularly for this evening, because he does all of this for free. And as you know, we, not intentionally, but pulled the wool over his eyes that there was only going to be 6 episodes, and here we are, episode 46. So as you know, probably, we've set up a thing for David where you can buy him a coffee, and we've had a really nice response to that so far, and people have been dead supportive and lovely about it. And also the merchandise that we sell from the website, as that's like mugs, t-shirts and hoodies, all the money for that goes to David. We don't take anything from it. It all goes towards David for doing the sound engineering, which is terribly kind of him. And I would just mention, you know, it isn't that long until the C word, and you might want to get some presents in before that. Not that C word, Claire. Not recorded.
No, I wasn't in Christmas. I was just...
You said it! No!
Just said it out loud. It's
Christmas. I'm going to have to go watch Elf now, and it's November. Only joking, I'm not going to watch Elf. No way.
I've never watched Elf.
Are you joking?
No.
Oh, it's good. It is good. It's really good.
Well, I'll watch that maybe on like the 23rd of December when I'm buying my Christmas presents.
Oh my God, Claire, are you that disorganised?
Yes.
Why am I not surprised?
But dear listeners, you don't need to be disorganised.
No.
You can buy for your neatest, your dearest mugs, t-shirts, Witches of Scotland.
Yes. What a great idea. So thank you so much for joining us, and please join us again next time.
Well, we'll be talking witches.
Cheerio.
If you'd like to learn more about the Witches of Scotland, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Sign up for our mailing list at www.witchesofscotland.com to keep updated with the campaign. On that site, you'll be able to find how to link with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.